With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you're listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's have some spooky tunes to get your chill on tonight.
I'm not the one who's so far away when I feel the snake bite and tear my veins. Never did I wanna be here again, and I don't remember why I came.
Stay by the end of my veins. Never did I
Well, it looks like you've stumbled on to another spooky episode of Savage Science Radio, and what's on the menu tonight? Voodoo. That's right. First, it's a special presentation from Escape called Papa Benjamin, and after that, a little anthropological perspective on voodoo itself. But first, this episode is based on the short story by William Irish, or a.k.a. Cornell Woolrich, and it's set in the French Quarter of New Orleans, where a struggling band leader named Eddie uses a sacred voodoo chant as a gimmick to help save his failing nightclub act. Unfortunately, Eddie doesn't take the threat of voodoo curse too seriously. This is an interesting story that will keep your attention. There is a moral here about what can go wrong. Of course, when an artist steals a sacred work from its creators, in this case, Eddie steals, then exploits, a sacred voodoo chant that he does not fully understand and cannot control. In the end, it's all kind of backfiring on Eddie. The sound effects are good, and the music is more impressive than the average episode of Escape. There do not seem to be any actual African Americans performing in this episode, but that's typical in the era in which it was made. Now, this show was broadcast on January 24th, 1948, for the first time, and Papa Benjamin is also an episode of the television series Thriller in 1961, and you might remember that on reruns, and you could probably get that on DVD. And the short story also appears under the titles Dark Melody of Madness and Music from the Dark. The 1965 horror movie anthology Dr. Terror's House of Horrors used this story as well. Now, sit back, get cozy, and get ready to get some chills. Papa Benjamin.
You are groping down a dark alleyway in the French Quarter of New Orleans, driven by terror, hounded by the curse of the Papaloi, a curse from which there is no escape.
Escape, produced by William N. Robeson and carefully contrived to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Today we escape into two worlds, one of modern jazz, the other of primitive voodoo, and to a doomed man who brought them together, as William Irish imagined it in his eerie story, Papa Benjamin.
Police Department, 4th Precinct, Sergeant Tolliver speaking. Yeah? Yeah? Well, pick him up on a drunk 723. Right. Yes, sir. What can I do for you?
Are you in charge here?
Yeah. Hey, aren't you Eddie Block, the band leader?
That's right.
Hey, Joe, look who's here, Eddie Block.
Well, never thought we'd get a visit from a big celebrity like you, Mr. Block. And at 4 o'clock in the morning... I suppose, though, this is just the shank of the evening for a big shot orchestra leader.
Oh, hell, what can we do for you, Mr. Block?
I've just killed a man.
You're kidding.
I tell you, I've just killed a man.
I guess you've been working too hard, Mr. Block. You're imagining things.
Here, here's the gun. Look at it.
Sit down, Block. Better have a drink of water. You'll feel better.
No. I'm all right.
Sarge?
Yeah?
This gun's been used all right. Smell.
Was it an accident, Mr. Block?
No.
Who'd you use it on? Who was it?
I don't know his name. They call him Papa Benjamin.
Sounds like...
Yeah. A white man?
No. He was a Negro.
Well, now, in New Orleans...
No. It was nothing like that.
Well, what was he doing to you?
He was killing me.
Killing you? But how?
Look at me. I used to weigh 200 pounds. I'm down to 102.
Yeah, but how? How was he killing you?
Would you believe in anything you can't see, can't hear, can't touch?
Well...
I've been to the biggest doctors in the world. If they don't believe me, how can I expect you to? They'll simply say I'm cracked and let it go at that. I don't want to spend the rest of my life in an asylum.
Look, Mr. Black, you say he was a Negro named Papa Bench.
Yes, yes, an old, old man, 80, maybe 90. Skin and bones, he could hardly walk. And I shot him.
You sure? You sure you killed him?
Yes, of course.
Where?
I don't know exactly. In a little back alley in the Vieux Carré, near Congo Square.
Supposing you take us there, can you do that? Then maybe we'll find out this is just a bad dream.
This is the alley. To the right, between the buildings.
All right, let's go. You pack, Sarge?
Catch cold without it.
Don't go back there, honey.
Quiet, you.
Oh, cops.
Nice neighborhood.
This is it. In that door and up the stairs.
Now, come on.
No. Don't make me go up there again, please.
You better come, Mr. Block. You're showing us.
Yeah, flash your light. Somebody here on the stairs.
He won't bother us. Dead drunk. Now step over him and let's go. This ain't the most pleasant neighborhood to come calling on.
This it?
Yes. In that door.
Come on.
Better call a commissioner. Mr. Block wasn't kidding. This man's dead.
But why? Why?
Because he was killing me, Commissioner.
Then it was self-defense.
He never came near me once. I was the one who went to him. I offered him $3,000, $10,000, any amount, and he refused. I offered him my gun and asked him to shoot me with it to get it over with quickly and not to drag it out any longer.
Then when he said no, you shot him?
Yeah. So you can lock me up now.
Mr. Block, do you think we want to hang a murder rap on you, one of the most popular celebrities in the United States? Use your head. I'm trying to find an out for you.
He was killing me.
Look, an 80-year-old colored man who's so feeble he can't even go upstairs by himself, who has to have his food pulled up to him in a basket, is killing who? A stumble bum his own age? No. Mr. Eddie Block, the top band leader of America, who can name his own price anywhere, who has about everything a man can want. Tell me just one thing, Mr. Block. How was he killing you?
By thinking thought waves of death that reached me through the air.
Now, Mr. Block, you surely don't...
You want to hush the whole thing up, don't you?
No, Mr. Block, no. But I'm going to get the whole story. So you might as well start telling me from the beginning.
All right. It began one night about 2 years ago. We were playing at Maxim's on Charles Street. We were just another band. Small Dixieland outfit then. Eddie Block and his chips. Judy Jarvis, my wife, did the vocals. But we weren't setting the world on fire. Business was so bad. I know what to expect when I got a call from the manager one night after closing time.
Come in. Oh, hi, Eddie. I thought we'd better have a little talk.
It's that bad, huh?
We took in $4,500 this week.
I see. And you can cancel my contract anytime it falls under $5,000. I get it.
Eddie, they can get the same liquor and sandwiches anywhere, but they'll go where the band has something. Tonight there were more waiters in the place than there were customers. Judy didn't even get a hand.
It's not her fault,
I know
Graham.
It's not her fault. She's okay. But I'm asking you, what's wrong?
I don't know. I'm getting the latest arrangement sent to me from New York. We sweat our heads bald off rehearsing.
Well, this is New Orleans, practically the cradle of jazz. You gotta give them something new.
Yeah, I know. When do I leave?
Well, finish the week out, see if you can do something about it by Monday. If not, I'll have to wire St. Louis to get Kruger's band. I'm sorry, Eddie, but...
It's all right. It's okay. You're not running a charity bazaar. But I didn't feel so cocky about it. It looked like we were on the skids. The band just didn't seem to have it. And I wasn't good enough to figure out why and pull them out of it. I was feeling pretty low when I went back to the deserted bandstand to pick up some music. The place was dark and empty, except for a couple of scrub women cleaning up. A dark nightclub can be an eerie place sometimes. I got that feeling just before I saw it. I saw it lying there on the floor between the stands. It was a severed chicken claw with a red ribbon tied around it. I almost laughed. How did that thing get there? Then I picked it up and tossed it out on the floor where the scrub women were cleaning up. I certainly wasn't expecting the reaction I got. They took one look. They turned and ran out. I just recovered from that surprise and was bending down to pick up some music that had slipped to the floor when I heard someone come in. I guess I was pretty well hidden from view. Anyway, he didn't see me. It was Johnny Statz, my drummer. And he was acting funny, looking intently at the floor, searching for something. Suddenly, he spotted this chicken claw on the floor and grabbed it up with a terrific sigh of relief, stuffed it into his pocket, and walked out. What I did then, I did on a strange impulse, and it changed the whole course of my life. I followed Johnny Statz. I suppose I just meant to catch up with him and have a cup of coffee with him somewhere and ask him about the chicken claw. But as I followed him farther and farther down into the Vieux Carré, down to Congo Square, it was a growing curiosity that kept me on his trail. When he turned into that dark alleyway, I stopped and debated. I felt like an eavesdropper, and yet something drew me on. And I walked up that dark alley. I passed that one lighted window.
I told you before, don't go back there, honey.
But I went on, through a sort of tunnel into another alleyway. Then I stopped. Ahead of me, Johnny Statz stood before a dark, dismal-looking old wreck of a building. Suddenly he whistled. A gigantic man appeared from out of the shadows. Johnny handed him the chicken claw, and he was motioned into the building. And then I heard sounds coming from the upstairs of that building. A throbbing drum, a wailing, an unearthly sound, and yet wonderful. An exotic, fascinating rhythm. This was music, something new, something sensational. Something that would set New Orleans on its ear and put Eddie Block in the big time. I had to get in there and hear it. I was mighty busy for the next 5 minutes. I ran back down the alley, overturning 5 or 6 garbage cans before I found what I needed. Then back to that lighted window in the alley and a 5-spot in exchange for a red ribbon. Then I was back at the dark building, walking up to that menacing shadow.
Blood up. Let me see your face.
Okay, okay. Easy with that knife. My ribs are tender.
Your face never been here before.
My friend, Johnny Statz, up there. He'll tell you.
This is Johnny, your friend. He asked you to come here.
This chicken claw told me to come.
Papa Benjamin sent you that?
Certainly. You'll make me late. Papa Benjamin wouldn't like that.
All right, go along here. First thing you know, all New Orleans is going to be coming around here.
I groped up the stairs, half expecting to feel his knife in my back. But I got to the top safely. Cautiously, I opened the door and slipped in. The room was full of people. They were in such a state of frenzy, I wasn't even noticed. I slipped into a corner and slid down by the wall, sitting on the floor. It was a sight I'll never forget. Wild, fantastic. fantastic, hideous, revolting, fascinating. In the center of the room was an incredibly old man, naked to the waist, wearing a hideous mask and holding a live chicken. There was wild gestures, weird incantations, frantic dancing, shouting and rolling of eyes, and there was blood. And always there was the chant. Nobody noticed me. After a moment, I took a piece of copy paper out of my pocket and began putting down the notes. It was wonderful, fantastic, wonderful. In 10 minutes, I had it, and I'd seen enough. Enough for a lifetime of nightmares. I began to feel sick, and I wanted to get out. I started to stand up. Suddenly, the room went dead.
Stranger is here.
His bony arm stretched out straight from the shoulder, pointing at me like an arrow. And there was blood on it.
What you do here?
Papaloy. I know this man. Let me find out.
No one moved. There was no sound in the room as Johnny Statz came over and squatted beside me.
You're in terrible trouble, Eddie. I don't know if I can get you out of it.
What is this, Statson? What are you doing here?
There's no time to talk now. You've got to do something quicker. You'll be a dead man.
Why? I'm in the very heart of New Orleans. They wouldn't dare.
Listen, you've seen enough tonight. You know better. Eddie, there's only one way.
What?
Join. Become one of us.
Oh, no.
It's the only way, Eddie. I can't save you. And you'd better hurry up. Unless you do, you'll never get out of here alive. You know what this is, don't you? This is voodoo.
Okay, sure. I'll join up. Why not?
Oh, wait a minute, Eddie. There's a lot more to it than you think. Unless you're serious, it'd be better to get cut to pieces right now.
Don't worry, I'm serious.
All right.
Papaloy, his spirit wishes to join our spirits.
The old man burned some feathers while the others watched silently. Then he nodded.
It came out all right. He reads them. The spirits are willing.
There were other things. Rituals, ceremonies, another sacrifice. Then, after the chanting started again, they brought me the sacrificial bowl. I didn't have to be told what was in it. I started to draw back.
Drink, Eddie, drink, or they'll kill you on the spot.
Late next morning, the band assembled at Maxim's for a rehearsal. When Johnny Statz got there, he found another drummer sitting in his place. Naturally, he came to me.
Hey, what's all this about, Eddie?
I don't want any voodoo lover in my band, that's all. Stats, here's a check for 2 weeks' salary.
So you're crossing him, are you? Brother, I wouldn't want to be in your shoes for all the gold in Fort Knox.
Hell, if you mean that bad dream last night, and I haven't told anybody, and I won't, I'd be laughed at. I'm only remembering what I can use of it. The jungle is just trees to me. The Congo a river, and nighttime just a time for electric lights.
Yeah, but this new number you're going to rehearse this morning.
I said I'd remember what I can use.
Listen, Eddie, that chant is sacred. Secret.
It was secret.
Eddie, don't do it.
Look, here's a couple of C notes. Hand them these. That ought to pay my dues up from now to doomsday, and I don't want a receipt. And if they try putting poison in my orange juice, they'll end up in a chain
gang. It's not that easy, Eddie. You're one of us now.
Oh, get out.
Okay. Goodbye, dead man.
Graham, the manager of the club, changed his mind about canceling our contract when he heard us rehearse the chant. Instead, he spent 5 G's in publicity, and Saturday night was set for the big unveiling. It seemed like all New Orleans tried to jam into Maxim's. Came to hear the voodoo chant, the real thing. Just before we were ready to hit it, Judy came up to me.
Eddie, listen, let's not do it.
What do you mean, baby, not do it? Well, this is it. This is our ticket to the big time. It'll be a sensation.
I know, but I got a funny feeling, Eddie. And look, I found this under your dressing room door just a little while ago. It sounds like a warning. Somebody doesn't want you to play that number.
I see. You can summon the spirits, but can you dismiss them again? Think well. Oh, forget it, baby. Stats is trying to scare me because I fired him.
Ladies and gentlemen.
All right, come on, let's go. They're waiting.
Maxim takes great pleasure in bringing you a historic moment in musical history. You're about to hear for the first time anywhere the voodoo chant, the age-old ceremonial rhythm no one but the initiated has ever heard before. This is the real thing, ladies and gentlemen, an accurate transcription. Not a note has been changed. So now, Eddie Block and his chips present for the first time anywhere the voodoo chant.
was a sensation. They went crazy for it. They screamed for more, but we were playing it cagey. Once a night, that'd pack them in. After it was over, I went back to our dressing room. Judy got there before me. She was reading a newspaper somebody had brought in.
Eddie, listen.
Oh, baby, you were wonderful. We wowed him. We're in the money now.
Yeah, Eddie, but...
Boy, am I tired. I feel more tired than I've ever felt in my life. Nervous strain, I guess, huh? Let down?
Eddie, look. Here in the paper.
Oh, who cares about the paper now?
Eddie. It's Johnny Stutz.
Hmm?
He's dead. He drowned himself in Lake Pontchartrain train this afternoon.
Hey, this afternoon? Well, then that note... It wasn't Johnny.
Oh, Eddie, look, you can't blame yourself.
Me? Oh, no, of course not, but I think I know who to blame.
What do you mean?
Nothing.
Eddie, why don't you lie down and rest for a few minutes? You look worn out.
Yes, I am. I feel dead.
Here, let me take off your coat.
Oh, be careful.
What's the matter?
I don't know. A funny thing. While I was waving the baton on the chat, I felt something, a sharp pain there in my back, like a pin or something stuck me.
I don't feel anything there now. Maybe it slipped down.
I don't know.
Couldn't have been much. There. Now you just lie down. You'll feel better in a few minutes. You've been working too hard, Eddie. You should relax now and maybe take a few days off. Hey, Eddie, look here. Where'd this come from?
What?
It's a little doll. It was lying on the dressing table. Why, Eddie, it looks just like you.
Let me see.
Now, that's funny. Look, there in the back. There's a little pin sticking in the back.
Yes. That's right where I felt the pain. That started it. Next day, I had a backache. Later, there was a numbness that spread to my shoulders, arms, and legs. I felt tired all the time, listless, dead. I began to lose weight. I couldn't get Johnny Stutz out of my mind. He'd introduced me to them, vouched for me, and he'd committed suicide. He knew. He hadn't waited. I decided to get out of New Orleans. I went to New York, playing the chant, of course. I had to. It was my biggest asset now. But nothing changed. I was losing weight, from a husky 200 down to 160, and I couldn't sleep. Maybe if I put an ocean between. I took an offer in London, toured the continent, away a year. I was an international hit now, the biggest attraction in music. But I was down to 110, dying on my feet. The doctors couldn't figure it out. Reynolds in London told me.
You're as normal, Mr. Block, as anyone I ever examined. You're so well balanced that you haven't even got that extra little touch of imagination most actors and musicians have.
I guess that's true, Doctor. I'm just mediocre. And yet you might say my success is killing me. And so, after 2 years, I finally realized it was no use. I came back to New Orleans, back to the dark alleyway down near Congo Square. I could just barely drag myself along, but I had to see Papa Benjamin. I slowly climbed the stairs up to that loathsome door and went in. There he was, Papa Benjamin, staring at me from the bed as if he'd been expecting me. And then he started to laugh. Take that curse off me. Give me my life back. I'll do anything you say.
What has been done cannot be undone. You think the spirits of earth, air, fire, water know what forgiveness means?
Intercede for me, then. You brought it about. Here's money. I'll give you twice as much. All I earn, all I ever hope to earn.
You have fouled the Obeah. Death has been on you from that night. All over the world and in the air above, you have mocked the spirits with the chant that summons them.
And please, here's a gun. Kill me now and be done with it. I can't stand anymore. All you have to do is shoot. I'll write a note, sign it, say I did it myself.
Death will come, but different. Slow. Oh, slow.
No, 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 no. I can't stand that. I won't, I won't. Maybe if I kill you, maybe then the spell will be broken.
No, no.
That's it. Kill you.
No, no.
That's all, Commissioner. Then I came here, to the police station. You know the rest. Well?
All right, Mr. Block.
You don't believe me, do you?
Yes, I believe you. Not about the curse, of course. That was your own mind. They planted the suggestion in your mind, and you did the rest. But it's plain that you killed in self-defense. Crazy kind of self-defense, but I think we can manage it. We'll try.
The commissioner managed it, all right. How is almost a story in itself. Our detective with a moulage false face posed as Papa Benjamin and called the voodoo clan together and into a trap. How they collected the evidence that proved my story. And how they sent most of that voodoo bunch to jail. My name wasn't even connected with the case. So now I'm free. I'm living again. I've gained weight. The tiredness, the numbness is gone. I took a nice vacation, went to Bermuda, relaxed, and had fun. Now I'm back in New Orleans at Maxim's, and the whole thing is forgotten. We're opening tonight, and the place is packed. Everybody's come to hear the chant. Eddie Block and the chant. We're on our way now, and nothing can stop us.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we welcome back on his triumphal return, Eddie Block and his chips, playing for you the one and only Voodoo Chant.
Look at them, Judy. They're eating it up.
Yeah.
What's the matter?
I was hoping I'd never hear this thing again.
What do you mean? It's your trademark. Yours and Eddie's.
I tried to persuade him not to do it. He wouldn't listen.
Why? You aren't imagining all that voodoo stuff.
I don't know. It was all in his mind and it nearly killed him. I don't think you can put it out of your mind and forget so easy. When Eddie plays it again...
Oh, nonsense.
Hey, wait a minute.
What?
Look at Eddie. There's something wrong.
What? Well, he's staggering.
Eddie! Eddie! Eddie!
Judy, wait. Now, let me pick him up. He's probably just fainted from the...
No! No, leave him alone. He's dead. I guess Papa Benjamin won after all.
Escape. Produced by William N. Robeson and directed by Norman McDonald. Today brought you Papa Benjamin by William Irish. Adapted for radio by John Dunkel, with Frank Lovejoy as Eddie Block, Louis Van Ruten as Papa Benjamin, Harry Bartell as the police commissioner, and Joan Banks as Judy. Music was conducted by Eddie Dunstetter. Next week...
You are speeding through the night on the Istanbul Express. You are alone and unarmed, and suddenly you realize that your life is in danger, that somewhere on the train are deadly killers from whom you must escape.
Next week, we escape with Harold Lamb's exciting adventure story, Three Good Witnesses. Goodbye, then, until this same time next week, when again we offer you Escape. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Well, it looks like Eddie got a little bit of what was coming to him, eh? And a little bit about voodoo itself. Now, the versions of voodoo which survived in the southeastern USA were connected with Christian mysticism in the minds of rural African Americans. Segregation minimized the number of bilingual African Americans, you know, those who spoke Basilect and fluent Akrolect, and at the same time minimized the number of whites who could translate Basilect well enough to discover voodoo in the spoken, sung, or written words of the middle class, working class, or the working poor African Americans. In isolated African American communities now, such as the Georgia Sea Islands or, say, in the Mississippi Delta, voodoo lore could be freely referenced and practiced, you know, at least the more subtle ones. Anyway, which were more public. And the more popular songs of the Delta Blues tradition, which would be circa 1900 to about 1941, referenced voodoo or its derivative hoodoo explicitly. Robert Johnson, of course, sang of hot foot powder sprinkled all around my door, and Muddy Waters referenced the Gypsy Woman, Seventh Son, and the Mojo Hand. Now, scholars debate the variations of voodoo and how they've survived and how much they've changed and to what extent Christianity in general or Catholicism has in particular been used as covers to enable the survival of voodoo, so it sort of moves as it's needed through the traditions of the community. And a common saying is that in Haiti, it's 80% Roman Catholic, 20% Protestant, and 100% voodoo. Thus, the Catholic contribution to Haitian voodoo is quite noticeable. However, in the U.S., the story may be just a little bit different, depending upon which scholarship you read. Some scholars believe confusion about voodoo in the U.S. arises because there's a widespread system of African-American folk belief and practice known as hoodoo, or more popularly said hoodoo, which would be like voodoo with just an H. The similarity of the words hoodoo and voodoo notwithstanding, hoodoo may have a tenuous connection to organized religion like voodoo or vodou, but hoodoo may be an integral part of the Voodoo religion in Western Africa, and arguably throughout all of Africa, some aspects of hoodoo may be derived primarily from the Congo and Angolan practices of Central Africa and may retain elements of the traditions and practices that arose among Bantu language speakers. Well, there's a little bit of background right there about voodoo and, you know, the story that we just had. And we're going to give you a double feature. We're going to do another one of Christopher Lee's Fireside Tales. It's called The Black Cat. And hearing him read these stories is like such a treat, because you read them yourself and you have your own voice in your head. But when you get a master of horror like him, who can put a little sinister twist on just the right parts, it gives it that little chill that you need on nights like this. This is Edgar Allan Poe's classic tale of a man slipping into murderous madness, driven there by his perverse love and hatred of cats.
It's getting late. Time for your story, I think. This is Christopher Lee. Welcome to Fireside Tales. Is that a kitten on the chair beside you? How sweet. I do hope it has little in common with tonight's feline fury, Edgar Allan Poe's Black Cat. For the most wild, yet most homely narrative which I'm about to pen, I neither expect nor solicit belief. Mad indeed would I be to expect it, in a case where my very senses reject their own evidence. Yet mad am I not, and very surely do I not dream. But tomorrow I die, and today I would unburthen my soul. From infancy, my tenderness of heart was even so conspicuous as to make me the jest of my companions. I was especially fond of animals and was indulged with a great variety of pets. In manhood, I derived from it one of my principal sources of pleasure. My wife, observing my partiality for domestic pets, lost no opportunity of procuring those of the most agreeable kind. We had birds, goldfish, a fine dog, rabbits, a small monkey, and a cat, a remarkably large and beautiful animal, entirely black and sagacious to an astonishing degree. Pluto, this was the cat's name, was my favorite playmate and attended me wherever I went about the house. Our friendship lasted for several years, during which my character, through the instrumentality of the fiend Intemperance, experienced a radical alteration. I grew moody, irritable, regardless of the feelings of others. I used intemperate language to my wife. I even offered her personal violence. My pets, of course, were made to feel the change in my disposition. I not only neglected, but ill-used them. For Pluto, I retained sufficient regard to restrain me from maltreating him. But at length, even Pluto began to experience the effects of my ill temper. One night, returning home much intoxicated, I fancied that the cat avoided my presence. The fury of a demon instantly possessed me. I took from my waistcoat pocket a penknife, grasped the poor beast by the throat, and deliberately cut one of its eyes from the socket. When I had slept off the night's debauch, I experienced remorse for the crime. But it was a feeble, equivocal feeling. The cat slowly recovered. The socket of the lost eye presented a frightful appearance, but he no longer appeared to suffer any pain. He went about the house as usual, but fled in at my approach. I was at first grieved by this evident dislike on the part of a creature which had once loved me, but this feeling soon gave place to irritation. And then came, as if to my final overthrow, the spirit of perverseness. The longing to do wrong, for wrong's sake only, urged me to consummate the injury I had inflicted upon the unoffending brute. I slipped a noose about its neck and hung it to the limb of a tree. Hung it, with tears streaming from my eyes and the bitterest remorse at my heart. That night, I was aroused from sleep by the cry, "Fire! Fire!" The whole house was blazing. It was with great difficulty that my wife and myself made our escape. The destruction was complete. On the day succeeding the fire, I visited the ruins. The walls, with one exception, had fallen in. This exception was a compartment wall against which had rested the head of my bed. About this wall, a dense crowd were collected, examining a particular portion with minute and eager attention. I approached and saw, as if graven in bas-relief, upon the white surface, the figure of a gigantic cat. There was a rope about the animal's neck. The cat had been hung in a garden adjacent to the house. Upon the alarm of fire, this garden had been filled by the crowd, by one of whom the animal must have been cut from the tree and thrown through an open window into my chamber, probably with the view of arousing me from sleep. The falling of other walls had compressed the victim into the fresh plaster, the lime of which had then, with the flames, accomplished the portraiture. Although I thus accounted for the startling fact, for months I could not rid myself of the phantasm of the cat. I went so far as to regret the loss of the animal and to look for another. One night as I sat in a den of more than infamy, my attention was drawn to some object reposing upon one of the immense hogsheads of gin or rum. It was a black cat, a black cat, a gigantic cat. This cat had a large, indefinite splotch of white covering the breast. When I prepared to go home, the animal evinced a disposition to accompany me. When it reached the house, it domesticated itself at once. I soon found dislike arising within me. Its evident fondness for itself, disgusted and annoyed. By degrees, these feelings rose into the bitterness of hatred. I avoided the creature. Gradually, I came to look upon it with loathing. What added to my hatred of the beast was the discovery the morning after I brought it home that, like Pluto, it also had been deprived of one of its eyes. Its partiality for myself, however, seemed to increase. Whenever I sat, it would crouch beneath my chair or spring upon my knees, covering me with caresses. If I arose to walk, it would get between my feet and nearly throw me down. My wife had called my attention more than once to the white hair which constituted the sole visible difference between the strange beast and the one I had destroyed. This mark had been indefinite, but by slow degrees it had assumed a distinct outline. It was now the representation of an object that I shudder to name, of a hideous, of a ghastly thing, the gallows. I was wretched. Neither by day nor by night knew I the blessing of rest. During the former, the creature left me no moment alone, and in the latter, I started from dreams of unutterable fear to find the hot breath of the thing upon my face, from the ungovernable outbursts of a fury to which I now abandoned myself. My uncomplaining wife was the most usual and the most patient of sufferers. One day, she accompanied me upon some household errand into the cellar of the old building which our poverty compelled us to inhabit. The cat followed me downstairs, and nearly throwing me headlong, exasperated me to madness. Uplifting an axe, I aimed a blow at the animal which would have proved fatal, but this blow was arrested by the hand of my wife. Goaded into a rage more than demoniacal, I withdrew my arm from her grasp and buried the axe in her brain. She fell dead upon the spot. I set myself forthwith to the task of concealing the body. I could not remove it from the house without the risk of being observed by the neighbors. I thought of cutting the corpse into fragments and destroying them by fire. I deliberated about casting it in the well. Finally, I determined to wall it up in the cellar. The cellar walls had lately been plastered throughout with a rough plaster. Moreover, in one of the walls was a projection caused by a fireplace that had been filled up and made to resemble the rest of the cellar. I could readily displace bricks, insert the corpse, and wall the hole up so that no eye could detect anything suspicious. By means of a crowbar, I easily dislodged the bricks, and having carefully deposited the body against the inner wall, I propped it in that position, while with little trouble, I relaid the whole structure as it originally stood. When I had finished, the wall did not present the slightest appearance of having been disturbed. My next step was to look for the beast. I had resolved to put it to death. But it appeared that the crafty animal, alarmed at the violence of my previous anger, had fled the premises. My happiness was supreme. The guilt of my dark deed disturbed me but little. Some inquiries had been made, but these had been readily answered. Upon the fourth day of the assassination, a party of police came into the house and proceeded to make rigorous investigation of the premises. Secure in the inscrutability of my place of concealment, I felt no embarrassment. The officers bade me accompany them. They left no nook or corner unexplored. At length, they descended into the cellar. My heart beat as calmly as that of one who slumbers in innocence. The police, satisfied, prepared to depart. I burned to say but one word by way of triumph, and to render doubly sure their assurance of my guiltlessness. Oh, by the by, gentlemen, I said as the party ascended the steps, this is a very well constructed house. In the rabid desire to say something easily, I scarcely knew what I uttered at all. These walls are solidly put together. Here, through mere bravado, I tapped heavily with a cane upon that very portion of the brickwork behind which stood the corpse of the wife of my bosom. No sooner had the reverberation of my blows sunk into silence than I was answered by a voice from within the tomb. A cry, at first muffled and broken, like the sobbing of a child, and then quickly swelling into one long, loud, continuous scream. A wailing shriek, half of horror and half of triumph, such as might have arisen only out of hell. Swooning, I staggered to the opposite wall. For one instant, the party upon the stairs remained motionless. In the next, a dozen stout arms were toiling at the wall. The corpse, greatly decayed and clotted with gore, stood before the spectators. Upon its head, with red extended mouth and solitary eye of fire, sat the hideous beast whose informing voice had consigned me to the hangman. I had walled the monster up within the tomb. These fireside tales are abridged by Tamsin Collison, with music by Chris O'Shaughnessy and produced by Frank Stern. They are a unique production for Radio 2. This is Christopher Lee wishing you a very good night.
Well, on that spooky note, I guess we're going to end this edition of Savage Science Radio. Next week, we're going to do a little bit about the history and lore of the Day of the Dead, or Dia de la Muerta. And there's some pretty cool stuff about it, and wonderful traditions and celebrations here in the Southland. So, and across, you know, the United States now, it's becoming a pretty big thing. So, look forward to that, and have a very happy and haunted Halloween. Until next we meet, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you. Gonna leave you with a little Stevie Ray Vaughan. I'm
And